Hi, I'm Michael Miller, and this is Speaking of Meditation, real-life stories of people who meditate, why they do it, and how it's changed their lives. If you've tried meditation and struggled, or you're practicing and need more inspiration, I hope these conversations will encourage and motivate you. Today's guest, Nathan Larson. Nathan has a fascinating history as a punk musician, a film composer, and a producer of alternative music festivals. In this pod, we talk about his journey as an artist, finding his niche in Hollywood, and how meditation makes him a better grunge rocker and a more present husband and father. I think you'll enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Speaking of meditation, here's Nathan. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, Michael. Good to see you and hear you.
It's really good to connect.
Yeah.
So let's go back. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your history, which I know a bit about, but I've never heard the story of your development into music and all of this. So,
sure.
So go back to wherever you think is appropriate.
Yeah. So, you know, I was into punk rock, and I was going to punk rock shows starting in when I was quite young, you know, starting in the early to mid 80s. You know, my mom would take me to these shows, or I'd go on my own, and you know, it was really this was in Washington DC. We were living between DC and New York, and both cities of which had these thriving sort of punk scenes, obviously. So it was a tremendous time to be involved with that kind of thing, because there was a lot of potential. And mind you, this is before, you know, grunge and all that stuff. So there was a lot of, and that's kind of, this is the scene that fed that whole explosion, you know, and all those, a lot of those bands sort of were just coming up in that scene, and who went on to be super duper famous. And, you know, I just was incredibly lucky. It was a very great sort of DIY, do-it-yourself kind of scene, very sort of ethically minded and political and all this kind of stuff.
And your band at that time was Shudder to Think?
Yeah, slightly later. I was in a number of bands during in the 80s, and punk bands. One was called Swizz, and I just learned a lot during that period, and it really served me well, you know, to date, which is sort of ethical business practices and trying to have a sense of environmental issues and political issues. And then I kind of took an extreme turn, and I went, my band Shudder to Think that I was in towards the end, close of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, the grunge thing kind of exploded, and our friends, Nirvana, you know, became this massive sensation. And it was very weird to observe that. And suddenly all these, my contemporaries and people who had been in these sort of underground bands during that period, a lot of us were getting these tremendously big record contracts. So my band got signed to Sony in, I think, 1992.
Right in the height of that moment.
Yeah. So a lot of my friends, you know, were swept up in this as well. And, you know, you're 22, 23 years old, suddenly you are never having expected to really honestly make a living doing this stuff. Suddenly you are just have access to this tremendous corporate sort of structure where you can kind of spend a vast amount of money, which is your money in theory, but you know, and you think you've suddenly hit the jackpot, but of course there's always ways, the house always wins in those circumstances, and they've got it figured out. The upshot of which I had some incredible experiences traveling all over the world, playing shows, essentially was able to live off of doing music through the 90s, and that's pretty amazing. So there's lots of cynical stuff I could say about those record labels and things, but you know, the fact is that I was given the opportunity to, and it also deposited me right smack in the career I have now.
And it was also in that time period that you met your wife.
It was, yes. And she certainly was part of that incredible sort of surge of bands coming from the European side. She's in the Cardigans, as you know, and they had this gigantic hit, which was in the Romeo and Juliet film.
Right.
So that sort of dates it. I think it was 97 or so.
That sounds right. And that film actually just on Twitter had a little resurgence. All of a sudden people rediscovered it.
Maybe so. It's a very sort of meme ready kind of movie. You know, it's got all these sort of images. And so she, you know, from her, in her separate way, had her own, you know, journey. And we kind of came together towards the end of the 90s and met in that context and kind of survived it. We're friends. And we, you know, certainly had friends who didn't make it out of the 90s, you know, so, mm-hmm. or they did, and they were just incredibly wounded and kind of didn't make it out of the next decade. So it was a pretty stark, it all seemed like fun. And then there was a lot of stuff that truly was fun and from which I learned a lot, but you know, people really wiped out.
Then you moved from being as much of a performer to more composing.
Right. So I was, again, very fortunate to be kind of in the right place at the right time in the late 90s in New York City, where there was this flowering independent film movement that, and I happened to be, know folks who were making films, and I wound up doing a bunch of notable films, but in particular, Boys Don't Cry, which, you know, went on in 99, I think it was, to win Oscars and all this kind of stuff. So if you're, you know, make these films in a really kind of scrappy way, and then they get bought by these larger companies. So at the time I had sort of, I think, been paid like $5,000 to do the whole thing. And, you know, it was kind of done. And then it had this just second life, which was incredible. So, you know, once you sort of are involved with something or tangential to something that has that level of success,
you get pulled along with it.
Yeah. And the doors of Hollywood, you know, come open and, you know, beckon you. And, you know, so it was, I felt like I kind of fell from thing to thing, kind of, you know, in the 90s, it was sort of the major label record thing. And then here in the early 2000s, late 90s, it was this Hollywood thing that I kind of fell into and quickly realized that it was not going to work for me at all. Cause I'm basically a pretty, you know, I'm not traditionally schooled and I have no education in that sense. And very much I'm coming from the improvisers, you know, punk ethic kind of thing where I just sort of bang on stuff till it sounds about right. And then, or I hire people who can do the things that, but I can't read or write music and all that stuff. So.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, I don't think Hollywood is known for honoring a lot of education, but that's interesting scoring,
yeah,
that sense of being able to actually write the music is different.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I mean, traditionally, of course, it was that you had, you know, these incredible composers, and, you know, certainly there's a thread of the people who really win the big awards and stuff are the folks who can sit down and write stuff for orchestra, John Williams and Hans Zimmer and these people.
Yes.
But then you realize that sort of they're operating on a completely different sort of budget echelon that, you know, I will never even approach. So
they're not
totally
writing the
fun.
Music for Prozac Nation.
No, exactly. So, and that's just another, it's just another sort of pathway, and there's nothing wrong with it. So I'm proud to have sort of been part of this, the first with the technology changing and with synthesizers, and with this sort of the vocabulary, the musical vocabulary that people hear in the context of films kind of changing. I was certainly part of this movement away from the more traditional orchestral stuff in films.
And you were putting together the songs that were in the films, not only writing the
yeah.
music, but
yeah.
what's the name for the person who chooses the pop song that plays
music
over?
A music supervisor.
Supervisor, yes, absolutely.
Yes. So I was doing a little bit of that early on, kind of before there were proper music supervisors, but now that's a whole skill set and a profession of its own. And it's very much, especially now when they're sort of not wanting to hire a lot of composers and they just want to sort of have all these pop songs in the film, that kind of curation is very specialized and people sort of get hired you know, into how it works in that industry. You just sort of, if you're associated with something that's successful, you continue to get hired. And that's the way, yes, the way it sort of works.
Now tell me what it is that you've kind of, what's the latest phase?
The latest phase is, I think I had to go through this sort of arc of, and it, I realized it was, you know, it's almost two decades of realizing I was in one place and not feeling like it was somehow adequate and that I had to work my way up to this sort of upper echelon of composers, having mentioned that before, and had this sort of like a sense of being an imposter, which I know everyone, you know, has, but that I couldn't read or write music seemed like a handicap at a certain point, because you recognize that these really, really high budget things, that's kind of what was required, which is totally not true anymore. But, you know, and I kind of spent a long time trying to sort of work my way up to that upper echelon and then realized that I wouldn't, it was never meant for, having sort of touched on it and been adjacent to it. It's just, I can't do that work. I just can't. And I don't want to. It's too stressful. It's too much politics and drama and really, really kind of toxic personalities and situations. So then I spent the rest of the time kind of seeing what I could do with my skill set and what that meant. And it meant sort of completely abandoning it for a while and then coming back into it on a much, much different way. So now, you know, I'm really, really so fortunate to be able to, I have an agent, but, you know, I have great relationships with a lot of different filmmakers and producers and interesting artists who are working in that field. And I'm at the point in my career where I can kind of work on things that I think are really fun and work with people who I think are interesting, you know, or work in a new context where I'm like, wow, that would be super interesting. I just finished up this Lebanese French production, and you know, that's because I had sort of, in my other sort of life as a musician, I had been in Beirut and met some folks and done some really beautiful interfacing with people there. And so that led to, I'm sort of doing the projects that will take me to places that I really like, you know. So that's tremendously, I don't know, I'm so fortunate in that way.
And then talk about this parallel of the sound festivals or concerts. What do you call these?
Yeah, they are as important to the music. I guess you would call them festivals, but it comes from this tradition that kind of was started in New York with composers like Lamont Young, who was a guy who was this fantastic sort of minimalist composer who started working with drones, again, very, you know, inspired by ragas and Indian music. And he worked with a lot of fantastic Alap vocal people who sort of do this vocal improvisation stuff. It's either really irritating or it's really great, depending on who's doing it.
And who's listening.
Yeah, exactly. And the Velvet Underground kind of came out of this guy's orbit. So it's a really interesting thing. And it's called the Dream House, and it's still in New York City in Tribeca. And it's an installation that is going on continuously in perpetuity. And it's this basically a bunch of sort of electronic tones that are sort of tuned to each other. And then all of this light and sort of like different sort of photographic elements. But it's sort of, the sound, the music, and the lights, and the sort of smells, it's very sort of incense suffused. So, you know, which either people find repellent or they find attractive, or, you know, what I love about it is that it sort of de-emphasizes the music part of it, and you're not... So I take that kind of philosophy with setting up these events. And the idea is that you, as a performer, are not trying to necessarily draw attention to yourself, even in terms of what the content of the music you're making. It's understated, and it's designed to get people into a certain space. And the setting is as important as the music. So in other words, the people who are there, the environment, the lighting, the feeling in the room, is sort of generated by the people who are there as much as it is the performer. So those are the kind of event, and that sounds sort of esoteric, and I guess it is, but you know, what's great about it is it sort of eliminates a lot of sort of ego stuff, you know, not in short supply in the 90s, where it's sort of like, look at my guitar solo, that's really great, and here I am on this stage, and I'm 12 feet above you, and I, you know, here's my fantastic composition that's super complicated, and did you catch it? It just happened, and now it's good. So this very time-based, stressful, sort of like, got to pack everything into these 3.5 minutes and just freak everybody out and then go away, you know, so it's about these extended time periods as well. So it can last for 12 hours, it can last for 24 hours, it can last for 6 hours. And the idea there is that you're given a chance to sort of settle into it as a listener and as a performer. So that's in so many words, that's kind of the principle behind these shows.
That sounds remarkable. I'm going to have to find my way. I'm going to have to find my way to one of these soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So speaking of meditation,
yeah,
let's go back. You learned in May of 2013. Can you believe that?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Remarkable. Yeah. You and your wife learned together. I remember it was quite a small course in that little apartment in the West Village.
Yeah, it was somebody's. Yeah, I remember it was beautiful and it rained and it was a gorgeous place. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great weekend.
Yeah.
Remind me, how did you get introduced to meditation? Maybe even before this, but specifically, how did we come to meet each other?
So we came to meet because I had a friend named Jesse Peretz who learned to meditate. I don't know if it was from you, but this same technique.
No, yes, yeah. He had learned from someone else. And then I don't remember who introduced us, but I met Jesse, who's a film and TV director.
Yes.
And he and I had a session to sort of get him back on track, maybe him and his wife together.
Yeah. And I think that's what that sort of precipitated, that he was like, you know, you really could benefit from this. At the time, I was also working on a show, an HBO show, where when they were shooting it, most of the people were meditators, and they would actually take a break about 3 p.m. and just the set would stop and they would go meditate. And
no kidding.
I had been wondering why it was such a good feeling on this. I was like, this is such a tremendously well run. Nobody's like screaming at each other. And even, you know, the folks who are traditionally sort of the more crotchety, like sort of union guys who light riggers, you know, New York, Brooklyn set tuning folks people are just really relaxed.
What show was this?
It was Girls.
Oh, right. So Jesse was a maybe executive producer.
He was
that.
One of the executive producers on that show. It was some meditators who were responsible for making that show. I think we met through another person who was friend of Jesse's. Anyway, I'm so glad that we did, because it just leads me here. You know, prior to this, I had tried some other sort of mindfulness stuff and had this mindfulness workbook where, you know, it's like you count your toes in your shoes and chew your food, you know, 36 times and then do, you know, so, and I thought that was kind of stressful. And I had gone to, I remember it was in the 90s, and I went on the Upper East Side to a TM thing. And it just felt so predatory, and like I was going to have to write a check at any moment. And it was very sort of like, yeah, I don't know, you're not doing it right. It was just a sort of, I didn't actually go through the process and get a mantra, because it just felt, I felt like I was going to have to start signing stuff. You know, it was very.
And when Jesse said, hey, it seems like you should do this, What was he observing, or what were you sharing that made him think that, or why were you thinking maybe meditation?
My friend Jesse Peretz was someone that I knew very, very well. And he had also, like myself, grown up in the Boston hardcore scene. So I was in DC and New York, and we were sort of tangential, would brush up against each other. He was in this band, the Lemonheads, who also you know, were punk and then kind of went into this machine of the record labels and sort of fame and kind of these, you know, they butted up against that a little bit. And so he and I had a very, and then he went into to film and TV. So he and I had a very similar kind of trajectory and a very similar constitution. And we took things super seriously and would just get really rigidly into something and then, you know, grab onto it and have to master it. And then we kind of would, so we were just both in a state at the end of the 90s where it was, we'd really kind of burned ourselves out, myself on drugs and alcohol, certainly, which, you know, were tools I felt that I had to kind of, you know, medicate a little bit. And so he knew me very well and we were, he was one of my best friends and we were living together. So he, you know, correctly thought that it would be something that I would take to. So that's it in a nutshell.
And when you first learned, what do you remember noticing or how did it affect you?
As I understand is often the case, it was a very powerful, almost immediate shift. I just noticed that I was able to drop my shoulders. I was able to confidently and without fear of having like a panic attack, able to address my day in a way that I hadn't been in a long time, if ever. You know, and of course that changed, and you know, I had the I guess this is a common thing as well, but I had this sort of slump where I had de-stressed to the point of my norm was kind of de-stressed. And so I was like, why isn't this still working as powerfully as it once was, you know, that sort of classic thing. But, you know, I stayed with it and it's really proven to be a stabilizing thing for me.
And how do you think it's affected creativity and work? Because when I hear your story, which is so fascinating, kind of the range of that. And I was in Seattle in the 90s when all of that was happening. So many artists and theater people and musicians were moving there. And you see that kind of raw creativity and expression, but maybe it's not that focused or directed or productive. And you somehow have found a way to be focused and directed and productive. I wonder how meditation has affected or contributed to that.
You know, speaking of that period of this burst of creativity that was sort of in the air, and I, that was all, at least from my standpoint, and I know from the friends that I was, had, it was based on a sort of, I don't want to say nihilism, but it was based on this sort of youthful energy that was also quite chaotic and required a certain, you burned up more calories doing it than you would, you know, and then you would have to replenish yourself, but you didn't, you were, you know, in your early 20s or your late teens, you just don't, that's not in your vocabulary. So what I found with meditation is that it was the first time in my adult life when I was able to be like, oh, this is something that is giving me energy, and not in like a drink a cup of coffee way, but like in a, now this is helping me get out of bed and go do the stuff I got to do, whether it's a jobby job or whether it's a creative job. So in that sense, it just supported my, it was almost, you know, like this incredible sort of nutritional, it just supported my person and got me out the door or into my studio in my pajamas, whichever was the, you know, I really credit it for that. I mean, it's just was incredible. But, you know, I don't think I was open to it or prepared to go in when I was, you know, expending all this creative energy in my early 20s. It just is sort of something I had to come to in my 30s.
We talk about how when you meditate, the mind settles down and you touch that state of pure awareness, that field of bliss. And sometimes we'll refer to that as the source of creativity. Have you found that your creative process or the product that comes out of that seems to be influenced by meditation. Certainly when I hear you talk about these 12-hour concert festivals with the droning music, you know, that does sound like it's related to the culture that meditation comes from to a degree. I wonder if it springs directly from there.
Yeah, I think that it's the this kind of community and community effort that these events, they come directly out of the experience of meditating. It's the closest I can come to in the context of a live show that accomplishes something like a meditative state or a state of transcendence, or, you know, and what's beautiful about this kind of event is that you can, to some extent, almost you create the context for these, for this experience, and you can almost sort of force it in people's consciousness if they're open to it. So certainly I sort of started to, over the course of, you know, this is going to be just natural evolutionary stuff, but also absolutely inspired and encouraged by meditation. It just became more and more difficult to try to create finite bits of music that was highly energetic and super packaged and small. And it just made much more sense to be expansive with it and to try to also, importantly, to sort of share the experience of and the joy of creating something on the spot. I mean, it's hard for me to say where the energy I get from meditation stops and where the creative energy stopped. To me, it's sort of a continuum. So they just sort of flow together. And at this point, they're kind of inseparable. What really fascinating, though, you know, if you have you read the Lynch book, the Catching the Big Fish book?
Yes.
So, you know, his thing that he always talks about with creativity is that he's never directly gone into meditation and had an idea presented to him that he, when it went out, was like, that's a great idea for a film or something. It was more like he would go into a state where he was receptive to new ideas and extremely curious in a way that he would have been naturally without meditation, but with meditation, it was a completely different ballgame. His waking consciousness was so shifted. So that's kind of what I think about it as well. I never get images or tunes or whatever when I'm in meditation, but it just puts me in a space where if I'm focused on a job or if I'm in a creative sort of state of mind, it's just a different energy when I come out of meditation and I need to do it twice a day in order to be sort of balanced, because then it sort of really helps me in my domestic life and in my friendships, that those things are now have a stability that they didn't have perhaps in the past, makes everything else so much more come so much easier. And if I want to apply myself to work, I can do so knowing that I've done my part as a partner, a domestic partner, and as a friend, in a way that I kind of couldn't have before, if that makes any sense. So it when I'm working, I feel much more in the work and being like, this is where I'm supposed to be now. I don't have to think about necessarily, of course, it's not all the time, but, you know, I don't have to worry about this or that thing. I can kind of put most of my focus on what I'm doing. I guess I've been trying to avoid saying, you know, being present, but that's really what I'm getting at.
Well, when you have the energy and the ability to apply yourself fully to the different aspects of your life, and especially I was wondering about your experience of fatherhood, because you came to that, as I did, a little bit later than many people do. And I wonder how that has been. Your son was already around when you learned to meditate.
If there were all kinds of other reasons for me to learn meditation, that was really the thing that was like acute. He was maybe two. Yeah, he would have been two. And it was, I did not really flourish as a person and love the baby years. I wasn't a great, you know, some people, you know, really, I just really struggled. And I was like, I'm just being totally honest about, you know, I was just Wow. So, I mean, now it's like, it's amazing because he's got his own, likes and dislikes, and he's his own person and he's incredible and we can have conversations. But man, yeah, that was, it really shifted things. If only taking the, what it did for sleep, what it did for my ability, I used to take naps. I don't know if you were a napper or if you are a napper, but I mean, that it's just not, you sort of have this sort of nap at 3 and then you have this kind of hangover feeling for the rest of the day. And yeah, being able to regulate the way that I absorbed rest and sleep and stuff, that just was a huge game changer in terms of being a parent. And then, just did such a number on my ability to relax and accept that this is, okay, it's a 2-year-old and this is what's happening with them right now. So, perhaps the first, and people will say this, but it's the first time in my life where I haven't been able to punch through and be like, I'm going to do this exactly how I want to do it. When you're a parent, you're like, I can't, you're like, okay, clearly this isn't going to work, and people have the sense that they're going to have a laptop and then have the baby and they're going to somehow be able to accomplish stuff in the way that they used to do it, but it's just not going to happen at all. So it didn't change that, of course, but it changed my ability to accept that and be like, this is great. I can be with this kid in a very sort of in the moment type of way that I just wasn't, it's day to day, but man, that was just a huge thing for me as a parent.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. It's my experiences as well.
Yeah.
Nathan, you've sent a lot of people to learn to meditate. There's a whole branch of the tree that has come from your referrals. When you tell people, is it a little bit like Jesse identified with you, man, this is something you really need. Why is it, or what is it that you say to people to encourage them or cajole them or nudge them into the idea that this might be good?
Yeah. I mean, as you know, that you can never really cajole anybody. That's the thing, is that it has to be somebody who's in a similar place to where I was in terms of kind of a crossroads, being sort of hyper productive, but also on the edge of not being able to deal with their lives. So I really try to just send people who I know quite well and who I know are going to be able to, because it's not like you're taking a pill, right? It's not like you just can passively, you have to be able to be ready to do a little bit of work, even though the practice itself is effortless. You gotta, stick with it and make some time to do it. And that can be really daunting to people. I tend to surround myself with people like this anyway, but people who are just incredibly motivated in whatever they're doing and are showing signs of distress that I believe could really be helped by this, it frequently people who've also had, like myself, brushes with drugs or alcohol or, other things that, are meant to cover up stuff that are a deflection and something you're going to need to deal with later. And they're sort of realizing that their techniques aren't going to cut it anymore. So I've been fortunate enough to catch a few people in that moment in their lives. And, if the stars are aligned, they'll get into it.
It's interesting you bring that up because certainly there are a lot of people who come along having experimented with changing their consciousness in other ways. And we always say there's a reason that they call alcohol spirits. there is at a certain level a spiritual search that's going on, which is trying to find fulfillment through altering the way I perceive and experience through consciousness. And, making yourself less conscious with alcohol has limited benefit, but it is altered consciousness to a degree. And then certainly the different categories of chemicals that people try, it's not unusual that that opens up the possibility of, oh, maybe there's some more sustainable, more healthy, more endogenous way to address this.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's amazing how these things, you know, and I think that it doesn't necessarily need to be a substance, but and it can be, there's an extremity of behavior where, you know, and it can be like sort of a being in extreme relationship also with other people. So you are kind of abusing yourself with the kind of people you're surrounding with yourself with, and being in these really explosive situations and relationships, you know, that also is to me tends to come hand in hand with the substance stuff. But especially in sort of like high performing artistic folks. Yeah. And I think that's an important thing that I've realized is sort of connected. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to be a person, and it's hard to, it's just terrifying though, when I think about like the ayahuasca, God bless all people and all endeavors. And I've never tried it, so I don't know what the, but man, what I've heard about that kind of thing, I just hope, you know, folks, you know, come through whatever's happening, you know, I just
steaming and vomiting for 12 hours in order to have a little flash of insight. This seems like hard work.
Yeah. You know, but I'm not going to knock it. I remember I was in LA at this, Cafe Gratitude.
Yes.
You remember that place?
Yes.
Oh man. And the waitress was like, yeah, there's a session this weekend. And she was talking to my friend. My friend was sort of like, yeah, we're going to. And so it's this whole, I realized it was this whole sort of word of mouth thing that they would have these meetings. And you know, what's really wonderful, I got to say, jumping around a little bit, my old band from the 90s, got back together to do this one performance in Washington, DC at this club that we'd kind of started at. They were having their 25th anniversary or something like that. Mm. Three of us had independent of the other become meditators, you know? Oh. And, so that wound up, and it was just surprising, of course, that not so surprising given that we sort of all grew up together and we had the same kind of background and the same interests and kind of the same general trajectory. But it just made the whole thing of being together and playing music that much more. It was just easier. But on the other hand, what was really fascinating was that there's no way we could have written the music that we are performing in the current state that we're in, because it was just complete chaotic, sort of purposefully like off-putting. It's kind of the opposite of what I'm doing with these events, where it's sort of like based on one tone and things kind of go on and on. It was these really short, really complicated, super loud bits of music. Interestingly, we were just all so much more capable of having the kind of stamina and technical ability to perform this stuff than we were when we wrote it. Mm. Really amazing. You know, and I hear this said about bands when they get back together, that of course they sound better than they ever have because they've, you know, had the muscle memory for decades. But this was really special because it was very different when you realized sort of what could have been.
That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
What have you not said, or what have I not asked about meditation that ought to have been brought up?
Let me think. I think we hit on all this stuff. I think it's so fascinating, the way that I've really taken to it, and I don't know what I think about this sometimes, because my wife, she really loves it in a way that she loves going to a exercise class or something. She sort of, it's booked in her day, and then she kind of moves forward. And for me, it's opened up this expanse of sort of like studying things and these layers of sort of like, I'm reading the, you know, the Mahabharata and getting into the, you know, all the Vedanta stuff. And you know, and it of course occurs to me that you don't have to do all that nerdy stuff to have it be amazingly effective, but you can. And that's why it's kind of these endless layers of, it just is, you know, like any sort of science, you can kind of dive into it or not. My wife chooses not to, and that she sort of uses it in this, as this sort of support. is not interested in why it works, and I am. So in just this sort of in this very sort of OCD kind of way. So, you know, when I learned it, I certainly didn't know that it was, you know, based on all these incredible historical documents and all this, you know, relationship with quantum physics, and all of that is so incredibly fascinating. Mm. And again, you can either get into it or not. And that part doesn't really, you know, that part is just a life choice thing, or, you know.
Well, it seems from our conversation that that's how you've addressed everything in your life. You haven't brushed over the surface. Yeah.
No, I've dug it up and investigated the roots, and yeah.
Nathan, this has been really, really fascinating for me to sort of get this broader picture. And I love hearing how meditation has been a part of this last, gosh, coming up on 10 years.
Yep.
Amazing.
Thanks so much, Michael.
It's been fantastic. Have a great one, and we will connect again soon.
Okay, man.
All right.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You bet.
Say hi to the family.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. That's today's pod. Thanks to Nathan for sharing his story. Speaking of Meditation is written and produced by me, Michael Miller, with direction from Jillian Lavender and assistance by Emma Ray. With original music by Rich Jacques. That's RichJacques.com. And graphics by LNL, ELLE.com. Speaking of meditation, what are you noticing? Who is benefiting? How are you staying inspired? And when are you next closing your eyes? Bye for now.